calendars 97-2676, Cincinnati Bar Association, A. Noah Calendar. Mr. Cummins.
This is Court of Appeals, on the field of the Church of St. Agnes, the Cincinnati Bar Association. I ask that reserve minutes for the case.
Your time.
As this case has been submitted by and agreed to stipulation, as part of the record, as have the rules violated by Attorney Callan. Essentially, Respondent Callan failed to timely register with the Supreme Court for biennial registrations in 1991, 93, and 95. For the latter, the most recent of those two biennial registrations, his registration was submitted over a year late. Contemporaneously with that, he failed to, for three consecutive reporting periods, complete the CLE requirements and suspended from the practice of law as a result of that violation in April of 1997. During the same time frame, he undertook to represent Sandra, Sandy, and Gregory Allen. Gregory had been injured in a motor vehicle collision, driving an automobile that was owned by his mother, Sandy. After undertaking this representation, Attorney Callan filed suit in the Hamilton County Court of Common Pleas, but failed to perfect service on the defendants within the time permitted by law. After that time expired, the defendants moved for dismissal of the lawsuit. Respondent did not answer or defend against the motion, and as a result thereof, the court entered a dismissal with prejudice on October 9, 1992. Now, from October 9 of 92 through August 95, the stipulation is that Attorney Callan misrepresented to Sandy and Gregory Allen that he was advancing their case and pursuing a claim for damage. Now, when he knew full well the trial court had dismissed the cause of action with prejudice in 1992. This course of conduct took place over 2.5, almost 3 years after the dismissal of the lawsuit. In August of 95, when the Allen sought guidance from another counsel, the truth came out and they learned that indeed, years before, their lawsuit had been dismissed. Attorney Callan has stipulated that he violated DR-1-102-84 involving prohibiting conduct involving dishonesty and misrepresentation. The issues raised by this matter involve first the syllabus in the Fowerball case. And that issue is, in light of Fowerball, should our association continue to pursue as a sanction some actual suspension from the practice of law where the course of conduct violates 1-102-84, where misconduct is not an isolated occurrence, and where there is a direct detrimental impact on the client. The second issue raised by this case involves the refusal of the panel below to consider Respondent Callan's administrative rule violations, the failure to register, and the failure to meet the CLE requirements as a basis for sanction in this case. Other board decisions, as well as decisions recently from this court, have considered those administrative rule violations in the total picture, issuing a sanction, and later in this case, we'll seek guidance from the court to determine whether we should continue to raise these types of violations in our grievance complaints that we file as part of our work with the Bar Association. The Fowerball syllabus is where I would like to start in this case, and that, as you well know, tells us that where an attorney engages in a course of conduct that violates 1-102-84, he will be actually suspended from the practice of law. Fowerball was heralded by our committee as some clarification on the issue, an attempt to provide some uniformity and guidance on that sanctions which we would request when filing complaints referring to pursuing cases before this court. Sent a clear signal to practitioners that if you engage in deceitful conduct with your client, you will be suspended from the practice of law. Subsequently, and relater relies on power law and seeks some actual suspension in the present case. Respondent would request a lesser sanction relying on disciplinary counsel versus Kay. Kay involved, in a very brief decision, involved a lawyer who, taking this from the short case, on at least one occasion told his client that he had filed a Rule 60B motion after he had allowed the case to be dismissed by summary judgment, when in reality that Rule 60B motion had not been filed. The court case tells us that this was an isolated problem in his practice, and the sanction imposed in that case was a public reprimand. Now, the problem that Relator has is that the sanction in K is difficult to reconcile with the syllabus in Power Law. And essentially, that is why this case comes before the court today. I believe the panel struggled with this quandary also. It appears the panel made an attempt to kind of squeeze the facts of this case into the sanction set forth in K. I quote directly from the panel's finding of fact and conclusion of law in this case. The panel states, the panel does not know whether the respondent Callan lied directly to his clients more than once or simply led them to believe that their case was pending by avoiding phone calls. This type of splitting of hairs is brought about by the difficulty in reconciling what is said in the syllabus of Power Law with the sanction in K. Relator would suggest that either way, whether respondent Callan's deceit directed towards his client resulted from omission or commission, either way, the intent was the same and the effect was the same. Furthermore, this is not a situation where on one occasion an attorney lied to a client. This course of conduct took place 2.5, almost 3 years after the case had been dismissed. The stipulation is that he continued to represent to his clients that he was pursuing a cause of action for a case that he knew full well had been dismissed without prejudice, that he had not appealed, that he was no longer pursuing, was gone. Furthermore, this is not an isolated problem in Mr. Calvin's practice. A red flag was raised by the regular failures to properly register as required by Rule 6, Rules of the Government Bar, as well as the CLE violations in this case. Relator is asking that a sanction be issued in this case consistent with the syllabus of Power Law. This is a fact pattern where an attorney has, over a period of time, engaged in direct, deceitful misconduct towards his client. Conduct which has adversely impacted on the client's financial interests, delayed the pursuit of justice, and requires a sanction under the Power Law syllabus.
How did the clients come out?
Sandy Allen was the owner of the vehicle that was damaged in the collision. In summer of 95, August of 95, Mr. Callan, after being confronted by a new attorney on the case, agrees to pay for property damage. However, there has been no resolution of Gregory Allen's claim for personal injuries arising from that motor vehicle collision.
Is that a malpractice action?
That would be a malpractice action, yes. And I don't believe there's insurance involved, and it's still a pending matter between Gregory Allen and...
He doesn't have malpractice insurance?
As I understand it, he did not at that time. But unless the court has further questions, I'll move on.
Thank you, Mr. Clements. Mr. Hayford.
Please, the court. The Bar Association continues to rely upon Power Law as if it were the absolute last word on the subject on April 6th. There's a potential to rely upon additional authorities, citing three cases since K, which makes four now since Power Law. Where this court has not imposed the actual suspension, even though under Power Law, the suspension is warranted. This case is very close. Now, the other cases are Kobe, Crates, and most recently Eisenhower. This case is close to the facts in the case. And I would point out that according to the record, Mr. Callum was dealing with testify. It wasn't a two-year period or so in which he did not tell his clients that their case had been dismissed. That's the same period of time that Kay did not tell his client that their case had been dismissed. Kay got a follow-up reference. With respect to the damages, it's very interesting. I'd really like to commend the board in this case thing. Really look at things with an objective eye. The first notice to the client that something was amiss was Mr. Callum told him it was 2 years, and we stipulated that it was a violation. But if it wasn't the other attorney who dug this up, it was the fact, according to Mr. Callum's testimony, I told him I had screwed their case up. He didn't tell him how. He said, I'll pay you the property damage, but as far as the personal injuries of the son, you're going to have to get another lawyer to evaluate that. And he had, the record shows, paid for $250 in full in property. Interesting, on the personal injury case, this suit still has not been filed because Mr. Callum and the person now representing Mr. Allen continue to execute agreements told Mr. suspend the statute. And as Mr. Callum testified, I still don't have a demand from them. And it turned out the reason there wasn't a demand, Mr. Weaver on the panel asked him, what was their problem with the case? And he said, well, he was injured to one part of his body, but the medicals and the reports talked about an injury to another part of his body. So I think it could be reasonably inferred that their new counsel is having trouble evaluating the case, which is why they're demanding. This does not excuse what Mr. Callum has done here, but as Mr. Clemens talked about, the damage to the client is a concern. Here there was not insurance. Mr. Callum is ready to settle the case, but he did not get any money. Once he owned up to it, I think he's done the right thing. The Eisenberg.
Should we, in judging whether the client has been harmed, do we look just at economics, or do we look at the problems and the disruption, I guess, to the life of the client here and having to not have his case or her case filed as they had intended, but to have to go to another lawyer, sue the lawyer that malpracticed and violated the code? Do we put any value on that at all, a person's time and their, if it's anguish or whatever you want to call it, having to go through the legal process in this manner?
Probably some, but I don't think enough to make a jump between one level of saying that. At least certainly not in this case, where it appears that had they not had problems with the accuracy of the son's claims, the case might well have been settled. The property damage part was certainly settled. $1,550, and apparently that was satisfactory. But when you look at Eisenberg, the most recent case, where I think for the first time the court said, in the opinion, yes, we know about Bauer law, we're not going to apply it. I think it's the first time the court really said that, although Kay and Hovey and Grace basically the same result happened, and for those of us on our side, it was a relief to see the court say this because the Bar Association, especially the Cincinnati Bar Association, firmly believes until they say Bauer law doesn't apply, we will lay after them. Yeah, and I think that's true here. Here we get a case where the board stepped back a little bit and said this isn't all that marvelous case. We saw this in the Fiddler case last month, too, with different facts. limitations on the loan application, there was a holding factor, there was another mortgage on our house she was trying to borrow. That was, I don't know if that was to a federal bank or savings loan, that might have been a federal crime. I don't recall which was the lot, there's no actual suspension. In Crates, we have again a situation very close to this where the case is dismissed with this award of negligence, and he has difficulty advising the client for maybe a number of reasons. I don't think an actual suspension is warranted here. I don't think the board did either. I thought the board was probably, it's probably the most objective report I've seen from the board in a long time. With respect to the non-payment of the registration, this again comes up frequently. I know the other case was regarded last time where the board decided, well, we're not going to apply our policy and we're going to say this is misconduct. And in this case, the board says, well, we're going to apply our policy, there's administrative sanctions, we're not going to make a finding here. And I agree with the Bar Association that the board is not consistent. There's no reason why the case last month or the case this month, they should do totally separate things. But I would point out, with respect to the CLE situation, which was not present in the other case, Mr. Cowan was suspended in April of 97, and he is still suspended, although he's brought himself up to date and has filed an application for reinstatement in January of this year, and we assume that no action taken on that until this case is decided. If the court does feel an actual suspension is warranted, I would ask the court most respectfully to give him credit for the 14-month actual suspension he has been doing since April of 97. And I would also suggest that not to do so would be kind of a double jeopardy or a full punishment.
You mean if you're suggesting, Mr. Habley, if we were to enhance, if we were to take the position that an administrative, maybe a pattern of administrative breaches serves as a basis for enhancing, that in that event, or are you saying we would?
I'm saying he's been sanctioned.
But I mean, if he were sanctioned for another violation, you mean that sanction arises out of the breach of the administrative rules, right? Why would a respondent get credit for that unless we are using that as part of our sanction?
Right, well see, that's part of the problem when the court or the board doesn't comply with the policy and impose the sanctions, then you've got all kinds of multiple questions because he's been sanctioned.
For
CLE, he's been sanctioned for registration. Here, of course, they said, well, we recognize that, we're not going to do anymore. Say, for example, in the Pittsburgh case from last month, they're saying, we want more because of that. And keep in mind with the registration, if you miss once, you don't get this violation. So the nature of the violation with registration is multiple. So now you're saying there's multiple, because you would be getting multiple on multiples. By adding something here
based on that. That's right, my question.
It was a multiple series. Now they're saying, well, in addition to that, you've paid your fine or you've done your CLA, we're going to slam you again here 2 or 3 years later. Sometime.
Yeah. So my question was if this court, it's the relator here asked the court to make this clear, you know, to decide whether or not those sort of violations can be a part of an enhancing of a penalty, or should they be treated separately? And if they are treated separately, if this court takes position that the sanctions for that sort of violation are covered in another arena, then you are not suggesting that your client would get credit on if we found a Fauerbaugh violation here, he's not getting some credit for time because he had this other.
I'm arguing that basically the court against compassion, I understand what you're saying. Because of all these cases I'm citing, which are very, very close to the facts where no suspension was granted, this court says, well, we think Mr. Cowan deserved an actual suspension. I'm saying, well, he has been off for 14 months. Now it's been been because of CLE. He was only, as I recall, a half hour or an hour and a half short at the time he was suspended.
Okay.
It wasn't one of those things where they just didn't go. And with respect to registration, the problem would be through the court, just say if you're more than 30 days late with your registration, it doubles from 250 to 500. Not that you won't get any. There are very, very few late registration. That's my suggestion. I have nothing more on the first.
Thank you, Mr. Hakley.
Thank you.
Mr. Clement, you've saved 6 minutes of your time.
Again, I have to return to the beginning of my presentation when I indicated to the court that this, facts of this case have been presented to the panel below by stipulation. It is stipulated that over a 2.5 year period, Mr. Callan was represented to his client, the case was ongoing, and he had been dismissed. Stipulated that at the time that Allen's contacted another attorney, Attorney Gary in Cincinnati, at the time Mr. Callan owned up to his wrongdoing.
Is it true that what counsel said that the non-settlement of this case is really not the entire fault of his client?
Not the entire fault of his client. Well, I think had he engaged in conduct in the court and not neglected and entrusted legal matters, this would have been resolved by Hamilton County Court of Common Pleas long before. Had he owned up to his allowance of this case to be dismissed improperly when it happened, as the disciplinary rules require, the case would have been presented perhaps 2 or 3 years earlier.
Right, I know.
And you add that on top of a great deal of anguish and upset that a client feels when a person to whom they go to entrust lies to them, and you present a situation where suddenly it becomes more difficult.
I understand all that. My question is still the same. Is there some problem with his former clients in their settling of the case with him now due to some medical problems that they differ on?
It's difficult for me to speak to the status of that case, but there, I understand there is a difference of opinion as to the value of that case.
Okay.
And that is why it has not settled.
Would
the client feels that he's been more seriously injured than his adversary now.
Would that difference of opinion been present had he had filed the case? Would that be the same problem that he would be encountering with this lawsuit filed and everything all right? Is that the same problem that would be presented in the original case had it gone the way it should have gone?
I assume that the insurance company wouldn't give up its money without some fight. That's been my experience. However, on top of that, now we have issues of, and I'm not going to argue this malpractice case, but we have issues of anguish and other issues that have been raised that are damages that result directly from Mr. Callan's malpractice situation. The point being, I think, allows us to distinguish the Callan case from the other cases which respondents cited. Hovey involved a client who failed to disclose a loan to a lender. There was no deceit directed at the client, no financial harm whatsoever to the lender, and the sanction was 6 months suspended or stayed. 6 months suspension, all of it stayed. Case doesn't even involve a 11284 violation. It's an out-of-state attorney who stipulated that he would not practice further in Ohio, and parties stipulated to a rubber band. So that case is inadvisant to the facts of the case before this court. Calvin Eisenberg involved a lawyer who traced signatures of beneficiaries on an inventory form. A clear misconduct, but no damage or harm to the beneficiaries or client that case. Also, as with Hovey, a singular incident in an otherwise exemplary practice of law. I would ask the court weigh Eisenberg against a decision at issue at the very same time, Bandy, where there was a forged attestation on will which caused direct harm to the client, resulting in 2 year suspension with 18 months stay. In the present case, Attorney Callan deceived his client for 2.5, 3 years. He violated a trust that every client brings to the relationship with an attorney.
What do you feel the proper sanctions should be?
I believe that there has to be, according to power of law, some suspension from the practice of law. I understand the rule can be 6 months to 2 years, but you can stay or any portion of that as you see fit. Relator's position is that there should be some suspension. It can be 6 months or 3 months stay, but there needs to be some actual suspension according to power of law.
Is it your feeling? I'm sorry. Is it your feeling that 6 months stayed is the same as 6 months actual?
No. Mm-hmm. I do not. The actual language of Powerball, as we interpret it, is that there needs to be some actual suspension resulting from the DR11284 violation in this case. Well,
because you threw out 3 months stayed, or, you know, you're confusing me, because I asked you what you felt would be the appropriate sanction in this matter, and you're throwing out various things with stayed and unstayed. Do you have one answer to that?
The answer to the question is that the relator feels that there should be a 6 month suspension with some portion of it not being stayed, so that Attorney Talman does serve an actual suspension for his DR11284 misconduct.
Okay. Thank you.
And so I take it what you're saying. It's really important to you that we have a bright line test and always take people out where there's
power law. Yes, that's your question. I think power law provided a bright line test. I don't think that it removes discretion from the sanction given, but it tells every attorney in the state of Ohio that if you violate DR11284, you're going to do some time suspended from the practice of law, and I believe that serves the proper valid public interest and should be allowed.
And he said at the time they moved.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clements. The case is submitted. You'll be advised for opinion.
That's the least concern. So,